This is Studio 395, a production of the Department of History at James Madison University and its Historical Research Methods course, History 395. I'm Thomas Weber, a junior history major. Today, I'm joined by Luke Dunn, another junior history major who also happens to be my roommate. Luke, how are you?
Pretty good, thanks.
Good, good. Well, to start off, here's a question for the listener. Is there any way that you can imagine a war between Afghan guerrilla fighters and the Red Army of the Soviet Union? Probably not. Now, is there any way you can imagine the Afghans winning? This is the story of what happened at the end of a decade-long Soviet campaign in Afghanistan, which led to the eventual collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. So, Luke, my research was about the Tet Offensive in the context, and the Vietnam War, and the media fiasco that ensued. Our studies were similar in that they were both Cold War proxy wars. How, in your opinion, did the Vietnam War and its results have an effect on the beginning of the Soviet-Afghan War?
So, as you know, the Vietnam War was devastating for the U.S. in terms of international public opinion, especially in the U.N., and American public opinion of the government. It also was a striking blow to the United States in the fact that it was a realization that there's a possibility that we could lose this, the Cold War. And the U.S. was, in turn, looking for an opportunity to really return the favor for what the Soviets did to them in Vietnam. Another funny thing about that, National Security Advisor to President Jimmy Carter, Zbigniew Brzezinski, had a quote that he was the first Pole in 300 years to really get a chance to stick it to the Russians. So eventually, President Jimmy Carter authorized these things called presidential findings, which basically allows the CIA to begin acting independent of government without the weight of the bureaucracy on your back, so you don't have to get, you know, permission to do everything.
Right.
This, in turn, showed that the United States could really oppose the Russians by funding the Mujahideen, these resistance fighters. So they started giving little bits of money to them here and there, but it really wasn't much in the beginning. And they also published a lot of anti-Soviet, pro-Islam propaganda, and that threw the Soviets off because the Soviets believed that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt was sort of importing their ideology to Afghanistan through the religious scholars from Afghanistan who were studying in Egypt, when in reality it was really the CIA writing and publishing these things to get the masses on their side, really.
Right. So, the Soviet... This allows me to segue to my next question. The Soviet Union's military power was matched only by the United States during the Cold War. How did the Mujahideen approach this conflict? What strategies were used? Obviously, there are very striking similarities between the Mujahideen and the Viet Cong of the Vietnam War. So what type of strategies did the Mujahideen use?
So, like the Viet Cong, they were mainly guerrilla fighters. They would hit and run and get little attacks in and hide in the valleys and outcrops, and that they knew well, and they had the home field advantage as the ones being invaded. And the Soviets, while they were in another country foreign to them, a land foreign to them, they had the advantage of air superiority, and the Soviet Hind helicopter was really their ace in the hole that they could win the war with, because the Afghans had zero air presence.
They had no answer to it.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So in response to that, the United States started giving arms rather than just money, giving arms to the fighters, and in order to not be found out by the Soviets that they were the ones behind the sudden boom of Mujahideen firepower was that they gave them Swiss Oerlikon missiles, I think they're called, and then British blowpipes. But at the end of the day, they were ineffective against the Soviet helicopter. And the only people who had an equal amount of military might was the United States. So we just said, okay, we'll give them the Stinger missile. And the Stinger missile was a portable soldier-fired missile that could pierce the armor and really bring down these helicopters. And it completely took the Soviets by surprise, because one day they had total power over the skies. And then the next day, their helicopters were just dropping one after another.
Mm-hmm. So what other obstacles did the Soviets encounter when dealing with Afghanistan? What not only military, but political issues, what types of obstacles were there?
So some of the struggles that they faced were the Islamist movement that was in fact coming to Afghanistan through academia.
Mm-hmm.
And as you can guess, the atheistic doctrine of communism and the heavily religious population of Afghanistan mixed like oil and water, and it was a bad idea from the start.
Right.
And things like land reform and cancellation of debt directly contradicted Sharia law, which is the canon law of Islam. And land reform was where they would take a wealthy farmer or a landowner in Afghanistan and take all their land. And then they would redistribute it equally among the peasants. And even though at the end of the day this was profitable for the peasants who didn't have as much land as the wealthy person, they would not accept it because it was acceptance of stolen property, which is one of the cardinal sins of Sharia and Islam. And the cancellation of debts was seen as like usury and unethical, really.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing was that the political puppets that the Soviets would prop up, such as Khan and Karmal and Taraki, they had a lot of infighting. They were not necessarily unified on one front, and when they put one person up, they would slowly drift away from the Soviet will, and they would sort of push for a more Afghan identity and more of a separatist movement, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of days later, they would die in a firefight or be found dead or something, murdered by the next puppet that the Soviets wanted to put in. So
a great deal of infighting.
Yeah, exactly. And eventually that pushed the Soviets to invade, and it really put them in this war that was unwinnable, unpopular, and really hopeless. And it was the nail in the coffin for the Soviet Union. Some of the results of the Soviet-Afghan war was the immense environmental problems that followed, which was the destruction of the irrigation systems. For example, they used the scorched earth policy, much like the one they used in the United States in Afghanistan, where the Soviets would go to a village and suspected of harboring resistance, and they would completely torch it, and they would destroy it, and they would destroy their irrigation systems. And not only did this sort of screw over, I guess, the village, to put it lightly, this was a great challenge to overcome, because something like, I think it was 76% of the country of Afghanistan today relies on agriculture. So it's fair to assume that back in the 80s, that number was probably similar. And to have your irrigation systems destroyed, it's hard to come back from that when your economy relies on it. Additionally, during the war, it was so... there was so much poverty that people would go to the forest and they would cut down the trees and everything and sell it for fuel. And this led to widespread desertification in Afghanistan. It's incredibly dry and mountainous terrain, and the encroaching desert onto their farmland and into their cities was just a disaster for not only the economy, but the quality of life there. It was an absolute loss of the country that they once knew, that it was not really reparable to get the country that they had before the war back. And it's hard to move on from. There's a lot of things that came out of this war that it was really not good for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
The United States has to deal with, and everyone else for that matter, has to deal with radical Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And the Soviet Union, well, obviously their empire completely collapsed,
mm-hmm.
but the people who suffered the most were the Afghans. They
mm-hmm.
have their economy was destroyed, their cities are destroyed, and before the war, it was very Western, mm-hmm. very Western. And now they really have nothing left. And
I thought of one last question that I'd like to ask. I recently learned that during the war in Afghanistan, the Soviet war in Afghanistan, that it was something like 80% of the country was not touched or was never held for any significant length of time by the Soviets. What would you say about that? It was mostly that they were able to control the population centers like Kabul and cetera, like the cities easily, but something that said, I think the number was 80% of the country wasn't ever held down.
A lot of the country is not populated, mm-hmm. and actually, good thing for reminding mm-hmm. me, one of the things that the Soviets did for population control mm-hmm. was they arrested all these, first of all, they arrested all the sympathizers. Mm-hmm. They took their land when they were thought that they were harboring the Mujahideen. Mm-hmm. And, they were, because the people who lived in these, remote villages, oftentimes the young men would go and fight. Mm-hmm. And they were harboring them, they were related, but they would take them and take their land, and then they would, as I said, divvy it up and send it and give it to other people and do their land reform thing. Mm-hmm. But that put everybody else who was evicted into the cities, and that was easy for them to control there. Mm-hmm. And most of the country is unpopulated. It's, like I said, it's dry and desolate, and you kind of have to live close together.
Okay. Well, Luke, I really appreciate it. It's been very informative. Thank you for listening to Studio 395. More interviews on a wide range of historical topics and subscriptions to our podcast are available on our show page at sites.lib.jmu.edu/studio395. To learn more about the history major at James Madison University, please visit www.jmu.edu/history. Thank you.